So before we turn to the passage tonight, Matthew chapter 20, I want to pick up a couple other verses that I think help set the stage for where we're going in Matthew chapter 20. I want to start with where we're going to land is at the resurrection, John chapter 19. Just a small verse there, John chapter 19, and I want you to first see verse 25. What I want to do is try to get a better sense of who are the characters, who are the people that are going to kind of come up in Matthew chapter 20. So John chapter 19, just a small verse, chapter 19, verse 25. So here is the death of Christ just before the resurrection, and we see verse 25, just the simple sentence, near the cross of Jesus stood his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. So do you know the name of Mary's sister? Some of you might have it, but just ask that question. Okay, now who is Mary's sister? Which would make this person Jesus's aunt. Okay? That's who we're thinking about. Mary's sister, Jesus's aunt. So then, just a little bit later in verse 40 of that text, I think of, of course I didn't put down what passage it's from. I think it's actually, my apologies, I think, well, I'll just read the text because it's from a different thing and I forgot to put down which of the Gospels it's from. But here's verse 40 of the text. It says, some women were watching from a distance. And among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, the younger and of Joseph, and here's the name, who have we missed in that little gathering of people? Mary's sister, and her name is Salome, S-A-L-O-M-E. So these are the people we're talking about. Mark chapter 10 gives us a few more indications. Mark chapter 10. So in Mark chapter 10, verse 35, here we pick up actually the same story that we're going to read in Matthew, but this is Mark's telling of the story. Mark 10, verse 35, then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. So again, we're kind of putting these different pieces together on who are the people we're talking about when we turn back to the text in a moment. So we'll do that. Matthew chapter 20. Let's look at the opening of this to try to understand who are the people in our text tonight. Then Mary, verse 20, or then the mother of Zebedee's sons. So who are Zebedee's sons? You just learned that from Mark chapter 10, James and John, okay? And remind me, who are the people that went up to see Jesus and Moses and Elijah at the transfiguration? James, John, and Peter. So this is like the central grouping of people, Peter, James, and John. You can just kind of roll that off your lips. Peter, James, and John. Peter, James, and John. Two of those are brothers, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, whose mother is Salome. So James and John, are you tracking with me, are actually first cousins of Jesus. They have the intimate familial connection to Jesus Christ. All of what I just said will come into play in a little bit. But I want you to see who are the players, who are the people that we're talking about when we open the text. So here it is, chapter 20, verse 20, the mother of Zebedee's sons, James and John, mother Salome, sister who's Mary, came to Jesus with her sons and kneeling down, note her posture. Right off the bat, we understand that Salome understands who this person is. It's Jesus who she's talking to. She understands the weightiness of what she is doing to coming into his presence. And so she kneels down and then asks a favor of him. Now we'll get to the favor. But the favor that she's going to ask comes into the context of some of the other things that Jesus has been talking about. Do you remember our sermon last week about the great reversal, right? The first will be last and the last will be first. We saw the 11th hour people, the workers in the vineyard, remember, receiving the same thing that the first hour workers received. We see Jesus welcoming those 11th hour workers first. The landowner has done so and given them the same amount of money as the first hour workers. The last shall be first. The first shall be last. We saw the rich young ruler come with all the, quote, money and then leaving empty-handed because he couldn't come to the point of giving it all up to receive and follow after Jesus. And then Jesus makes this really powerful statement at the end of verse 13 of chapter 20 of Matthew. But he answered one of them, "Friend, I'm not going to be unfair to you. Didn't you agree to work for denarius? Take your pay and go. I want to give you the man who was hired last the same as you. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my money? Or are you envious because I am generous?" This is the beautiful reality of Jesus over and over reminding us of the generosity of our God. And part of that generosity is seen in chapter 19, where Jesus reminds Peter, who's trying to get the understand, if it's impossible for us to belong to the kingdom, what's then in it for us? How can this possibly be? And he says in verse 28 of chapter 9, "I tell you the truth, at the renewal of all things, when the Son of Man sits on his glorious throne, you who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel." We don't know exactly how that all would play out, but what we do know by where we're headed in Matthew 20 is that James and John heard that. And they probably explained that little verse to their mother. Well, at the end of the parable of the vineyard, Jesus breaks into, this is verse 17, one of the three times that he mentions his coming death to the disciples. The last time he did, Peter became angry with him, remember? "No, we're going to stand with you, Jesus, until the very end. What are you talking about? How can it possibly be that you're saying that these people will come and get you?" Jesus says, "Now as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took his 12 disciples aside and he said to them, 'We are going up to Jerusalem and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and teachers, to the teachers of the law, and they will condemn him to death.'" And watch this progression. God has sent his Son, and God sends his Son to stand underneath the chief priests and the teachers of the law, the highest echelons of the leadership. And Jesus is sent to be underneath of them. They will condemn him to death. And then there's a new level of betrayal, and they will turn him over to the Gentiles, to be mocked and flogged and crucified. And then on the last day, on the third day, the Father comes back in and raises His Son to new life. It's just this little window into what is to come, punctuating the story about the last being first and the first shall be last. What is Jesus hinting at? Not only is He telling them something about what He's going to do, but He's setting up the model by which He's going to do this incredible work of saving His people. Verse 20. The mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and, kneeling down, asked a favor of Him. And now here's the favor. See Jesus in His mind? Kneeling, His aunt sitting, kneeling before Him. And the question, what is it that you want? When someone is saying what they want to Jesus, what is that in one word? So we just got finished doing together. Asking a want, saying, God, please give us rain. God, please bring about the right time for a surgery. What is this? This is as close to a prayer as we see in the text. This is Salome praying to Jesus, lifting up her requests to the Son of God. It's important to think about that. We'll get to some more here. And this is her prayer. This is her request. Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom. Do you see how that goes back to chapter 19? Jesus saying that the day will come where you'll be sitting on the thrones. And this is Zebedee's mother, or the sons of Zebedee's, the mother's request. May my sons receive a place of higher honor than the rest of those disciples. So do you think that the sons of Zebedee, James and John, asked the same thing? Were they wondering and hoping the same thing? Well, keep your finger there and just remember, let's look at Mark 10, a very same story. We've already been there, but here we see Mark's telling. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to Him. And who are the speakers here in this telling? Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. Well, what do you want me to do for you? Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory. Some will say, well, this seems like a discrepancy. But really, many have said, no, there's no discrepancy here. This is the heart's desire of the three of them. And in one telling, you can hear the disciples talking about what the mother has said. The mother has asked the request, and the disciples gather in, James and John, and speaking about their request right along with them. And it's interesting to note, and it's so hard to see this in chapter 20 in the original, but when you look at the words, verse 22 of Matthew chapter 20, the very first word in the text says, you. This is where the southern accent really works. It really should be you all, because that's the plural. Jesus is not responding simply to the mother. In other words, this is a request coming from James, John, and Mom. What is it you want? You don't know what you're asking, Jesus said to them. Can you drink the cup I'm going to drink? when Jesus used these words, the cup, that is the statement that this is the divine reality of what is to come. The cup is what is prepared in advance. This is what is going to happen to you. And Jesus has already said he knows exactly what that cup is going to be. The cup of betrayal, of flogging, of death. This is the cup that is going to come. And he wants to challenge them. Can you drink of the cup that's going to come to you? They quickly answered, "We can." How little would they know what they were answering to? We'll say more about that later. It was John Calvin who just said this that I thought was so good, I just put it up for you to read along with me. Here in this simple text, the story is a clear mirror of human vanity. It teaches that ambition is often entwined in a right and godly zeal. It is not enough for a mind to be sincerely directed to Christ in the beginning, but it must keep on always in the same path of purity. For often depraved thoughts and feelings come over us in the middle of the race and turn us off course. Well said. I couldn't even begin to say it even close to that well. That's why I wanted you to see it. This is Eugene Peterson's The Long Obedience in the same direction. James and John, you've done so well, but here you've come to this point and human ambition has got the best of you. Even to the point of when asked, "Can you possibly bear this cup?" they are instantly able to say, "We can." It was Frederick Bruner who made the point, so often it's in life where we have to somehow walk between these, again, two ditches of this zeal of we can and of the sense of we can't. The we can be a good thing, because if we say we can in the power of the Spirit, we go and have appropriate ambition to do things we didn't think possible. We can. But sometimes that leads us astray into a place of humanism, of doing things that we ought not, where zeal leads us off the path. But then there's the other side, an appropriate balance to the we can is the we can't. Because we need Christ and His strength and His power, the gift of His Spirit to help us. But the we can't can also lead us into sadness and lethargy and excuses. Somehow we're always called to try to land in between those two, of the we can't and the we can. For James and John, they answered very quickly, "We can." But perhaps their zeal got the best of them at this point. Jesus, knowing, says to them in verse 23, "You will indeed drink from my cup." He knew. What did he know? What James and John didn't know at that time. Turn to Acts chapter 12. You see here in this text, again, Peter's miraculous escape. Peter is the one who is continuing to pray, and he gets up and we see the reality of the escape. We finally get to Herod's death. And finally it comes to the point where we see that Herod went to Judea, to Caesarea, and stayed there a while. He had been quarreling with the people of Tyre and Sidon, and now joined together and sought an audience. On the appointed day, Herod, wearing his robe, sat on his throne and delivered a public address. Immediately, because Herod did not give praise to God, he died. Barnabas and Saul had finished their mission. They returned to Jerusalem, taking with them John. So where's James? What we find is that James is one of the first people who is martyred, who dies for what he believes. Verse 1 of that same text, chapter 12. It was about this time that King Herod arrested some who belonged to the church, intending to persecute him. And he had James, the brother of John, put to death with a sword. We've studied Revelation long enough to know that John would be exiled on an island in Patmos. Matthew chapter 20, James and John vehemently say, "We can carry and we can carry this cup." Little did they know that it would indeed cost them their life and separation from all they loved. You will indeed, chapter 20 of Matthew, verse 23, you will drink from my cup. But then Jesus goes on and says this, "But to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared by my Father." What we see just in that simple way is Jesus, again, his limitations. In Philippians, we see the reality of Jesus leaving the heavenly throne and coming to earth. And in that, limiting himself, there's a limitation to what he knows. What else does he not know? He speaks about not knowing when the end will come. In the same way, he says, "This is not my place to say who is going to be on this throne or that throne." No, that's for my Father to determine. Verse 24, when the 10 heard about this, what is the heard about this? Well, this request from James and John. And what was the crest? The request? They wanted to have a special seating in the throne room of God. And what were they using as their little, trump card to be able to play to be in front of the line? "We got an in with the family. You know that Jesus? It's my cousin." What were they indignant about? It says the text. They were indignant. And I think this is an interesting part of the text. They weren't indignant at the request. It was likely they were indignant that they requested it and that they were trying to jump the line. They were playing the family card and they didn't like it. What should have bothered them more? That they had asked the question at all. Perhaps even their zeal, their unfounded zeal, got them to the wrong place. Some commentators have pointed out, and I think so beautifully, that yes, the mothers of the sons of Zebedee and James and John, yes, are praying. They're asking a request. But what happens to the request? It goes unanswered. And perhaps it actually is answered with a no. James, in the book of James, chapter 4, would say this, "You ask and you do not receive because you ask wrongly." You see, when we ask for things that are against God's will, that are for selfish gains, there are times where God says, absolutely not, no. So it is here for this request. And then this beautiful conclusion that Jesus finally then draws the disciples together. You see verse 25? He's had the time to kind of teach the sons of Zebedee this question. Now it's time to teach the rest of the disciples. You gather them all around. And he sets this all straight. You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. He looks at the culture and he sees a hierarchy of leadership, a hierarchy of authority, and how one lords it over the next, there's a clear and definite line. And then he says, verse 26, not so with you. James and John, you wanted to be above. You wanted to jump the line and maybe kind of get ahead of your fellow disciples. This is not the way the church operates. This is not the way the people of God operate. One lording it over the other. You'll hear me use those words when we talk about elders and deacons. That's one of the really important pieces that we've learned in the church, or the Christian Reformed Church and other churches, is that elders and deacons are not somehow like this in the authority structure. They're equal people of God, given different tasks, different things on which they are to manage and oversee. They are not to be seen this way, like one ruling authority over the other. Verse 26 again, not so with you. Disciples, you're going to go out, and we can't have the thing of Peter is calling the shots and everybody is yes men around you, or James and John trying to jump the ship and try to get ahead of the other ones. No, not so with you. Instead, and here's where Jesus has this upside down kingdom. Instead, whoever wants to become great, so great is not going to be having a family connection. Great is not to be sitting on the throne and asking for privilege. No, greatness comes when you are a servant. Wow. And then we hear those words again that we've been hearing over and over in these last chapters. And whoever wants to be first must be a slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. And to give his life as a ransom for many. Here in this last verse of this text, Jesus sets the stage for what he's about to do. A ransom is the price paid to release a slave from its work, the price paid to an owner to allow the slave to go free. And Jesus said, that's what I've come to do. I've come to make captives free. I've come to make sinners free. And how am I going to do that? I'm going to give up my life. I'm going to pay the price. The ultimate picture of servanthood. Bruner said it this way, and again, I want to just give you this quote. He who did nothing wrong was condemned for everything so that we who have done nothing wrong may be condemned for nothing You see how everything gets turned on its head. The condemnation that brought us peace was laid upon the Son of God. And He becomes the ransom. Sadly, in today's day and age, many people have seen this and have stopped by saying, this is just a picture of the example that we should be. To be like that, servant-hearted, servant-minded. And the answer is, yes, we ought to. But there's something that's so much more. Jesus was not just simply an example. He was Himself the offering. Not just a picture for us to model, but He was the one who actually did the work on our behalf. He turned everything upside down so that those like you and me who had nothing could be given everything. What a lesson for James and John, for the disciples. And really, what a challenge for us today to think about leadership, to think about servanthood, to think about how do we approach each other. I love those words, verse 26 again. Not so with you. May we also be a servant as we follow after our Lord and Savior, who gave His life as a perfect ransom for you and me.